August 13th, 2019, session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been doing a little bit of work on a combination of Go and Java programming, or JavaScript programming, and working on reading off of USB ports and serving that up as data to a web server. So I had pieces of code, I resurrected them, updated them, and they seem to be working okay. So I've been doing that. A few other things. I did find an interesting video, I'll have to say, that was from 2018. It was the GNU Radio Conference in Alabama, I believe. And Bob McGuire was bragging about Nathan and all his graduate work. So it was quite interesting. So I'll leave it at that. Next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak recordings to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next, we have Nathan, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Thank you very much there. Things are going well. This is my first time checking into the TeamSpeak from my new home in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So I've been here about a week now. We moved last Monday. Things are starting to settle in. I'm getting ready for classes. I've moved into my new office on campus, and I'm working on setting up an office and a ham radio station at the house. And I think things are moving along. I also I found one Scranton student that I'm hoping to bring with me to the Tapper DCC, so I'm still working on that. Back to Ned.
Fine business. Yeah, our school is starting in next Monday, so we're kind of in the same boat. Next on the list, we have Rick, W2GPS. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, thank you. It's been a good week for me, but not necessarily for Tangerine project. My big project right now is trying to get my ham shack back on the air after having all five rooms on the second floor of the house completely emptied in June, and we're slowly getting, we had the whole place refurbished, and we're slowly getting everything back together, and the ham shack is taking shape. Everything is in different places, and some wires need wire stretchers and other wires need to be cut. And so it's going to take me a few more weeks before I'm back on the air. That's not very helpful to Tangerine, but I'll be certainly happy once that project's done. In the meantime, I've talked to John Ackerman about doing some more tests, but we have not actually done them, so I need to get to work. I need to draw up some schematics as proposals for the board too. That's quite easy, but it's just something that's got to be done that I haven't done yet. So there you go. Over.
Fine business, Rick.
User in your channel is recording.
And next on the list, we have Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and good evening to everybody in the group. Had a busy week. The receiver requirements document was updated. I got some comments on it, and in terms of reformatting it, made a few boo-boos, so fixed those as well. So there was an update to the receiver requirements. And then Scotty and I did quite a bit of work on the ICD, the interface control document for the receiver. And Scotty picked out a 140-pin connector. And then we got out a shoehorn and a sledgehammer, and we tried to fit everything in. And then we got out a bigger shoehorn and a bigger sledgehammer and worked on it a little harder. There's a lot going on in that connector, and I think we've got it all fit. Scotty did a good job of anticipating some future requirements for new modules we may not have thought of. And we have most of the I/O going through I2C and SPI. So if we need to add registers, control registers, GPIO. I think we can fit all of those through the I2C interface. So it's up on the web, and it may or may not make sense, but the advantage is at least it'll match the data engine when Scotty is able to get that out. And that's about it.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if you were done, or, but thanks, Tom. Next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
All right. Good evening, Dave, and to everyone. Thanks again, Dave, for running the TeamSpeak session, and also to Mike for recording and posting. And it looks like Dan is doing the backup job there of recording, too, so make sure not miss anything. Anyway, like Tom said, we worked quite a bit on the spec for the connectors, and so basically I started the framework of the data engine ICD and put that connector in, and we kind of went back and forth two or three times, and like Tom said, with a hammer and then a bigger hammer and then an even bigger hammer, and really tried to avoid having to go to 160 pin connector, because it would have ended up making the boards bigger, which would physically bigger because the connector was wider. We didn't want to do that, so finally settled on the 140. It's It's an MEC 140 pin. It's made by Samtech, and it's a little bit pricier than the M.2, but it's got 2.5 times the number of pins, so or double the number of pins anyway. So I think it's going to work out just fine, and then we've got a lot of expansion room for pin assignments for building transmitter boards and dual channel receiver boards and even maybe quad channel receiver boards, depending on the speed and the bandwidth that we need. So, and of course, then there's always cascading the two RF module connectors together and doubling the IO for a pretty awesome number of IO pins, probably more IO pins than the FPGA can handle until we go to the DE Model 2 with the Gigundo FPGA on it. Any rate, and the other thing that's going on is giving a presentation this Thursday to the Thunderbird Amateur Radio Club, which is one of the largest clubs here in town. It's over on the west side of town, and I'm going to be giving them the skinny on the Tangerine SDR project, so you never know who you might get interested. I'm just trying to get the word out. So I got my presentation almost done, and also be a good base presentation to start with for whipping up something for DCC, which is coming up, in about... Jesus, like 4 weeks now, isn't it? September 19th, 6th, I don't know. What are the dates? 19th, 20th, 21st, 22nd, something like that. 19th, I think, is a Thursday, but it's the end of that week in Detroit. So getting geared up for that. So back over to you, Dave.
Sounds good. And we got Bill, AB4EJ, back. He was gone there for a second. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Tom. Good evening to the net. Hopefully you can hear me okay. I'm in the car at the moment, driving along. And before I forget, I'm only going to be able to make occasional TeamSpeak meetings for a while, because I sing in a choir, which has we have several concerts this fall, and our rehearsals are, unfortunately, from 7 p.m. to 9:30 on Mondays. I'll make it when I can. As soon as I can get Travis Atkinson, our project manager, a principal investigator for UA for our part of the project, I may be able to get him to sit in occasionally. But he's the problem with him is getting on his schedule is tough. My week was spent working with Django. Still, it's the web framework they're planning to use for the central control system. Becoming familiar with how to do things like having an email out and verification for new join people who join, verify their email address and issue their token and all that kind of thing. So that's been a little bit frustrating because it's what we call interdependency hell. You've got 12 different software products that have to interoperate, and unfortunately several of them require different versions of Python, for example, and different versions of MySQL and all this and that. I know it can be done. I have a working example in Satnog's database system, so We're going to continue to work on that. We'll get it working eventually, but that was this week. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business, Bill. And next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave. Excuse me. Had a busy week, although I didn't really do much with our project. I did buy a Raspberry Pi 4, and I'm going to give it a shot and see how it works. I watched a few YouTube videos about it, and everybody seems to think it's the best thing since sliced bread, so we'll give it a shot and take a look at it. Also, messed around a little bit with some of the digital software out there. And I guess that was about it, Dave. Back to you.
Well, fine business. And so that brings us to the end of the list, and we're open for general discussion.
Hey, Nathan, congratulations on completing the move and getting there safely and getting the new house set up.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I really appreciate it. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, so, Nathaniel, did you buy a house and move in? Are you renting or are you in an apartment? How are you doing there?
I'm renting a house. It's about a half mile from campus. We figured we'd rent for a couple years as we try and figure out the area. I'm trying to figure out how to put some HF antennas up. One of the challenges, I have a backyard, but one of the challenges is that all the power lines are actually in the backyard. What I think I can do, though, is I think I can run some wire antennas from the attic and slope them down below the power lines and toward the back. I think that will get me on the air there. Over.
Yeah, good. Just use insulated wire. You'll be fine.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got to tell you, when I was at RPI, I rented a room out of a fraternity house that where they built a new frat house, and they had the old house, and they were renting rooms out to independents. And so the yard next to me was the dean of one of the colleges. I don't even remember which one now. And the next to him was a parking lot with this oak tree in it that was literally like 100 feet tall. So I ran 160 meter inverted L out of my window up to a pine tree that was on my right out behind my room, across the dean's yard and across the parking lot and into the 100 foot tall tree. Now, the dean never found out about it that I know of, because we did this at night, but we had to run over his power line feed to his house because the oak tree was really tall. First branch on the oak tree was about 60 feet up, and I got a friend of mine who was in the mountaineering club to come out with a rope and some climbing gear, and he actually got the oak tree end up in the tree. Oh, he probably at a good 75 feet. So it actually sloped downward to my poor little piddly pine tree in the backyard, and it worked amazingly well for kind of a half-baked antenna. So it's a... best thing you can do is just put something up and you'll make it work.
I agree. Let's get something in the air. It sounds like that worked pretty well, though.
What was amazing is I had a Drake TR-4 at the time. I had no antenna tuner. I had no ground. I was on the second floor of the house. I took the end of the wire and stuck it into the center pin of the SO239. And the thing actually tuned up enough. I worked a guy in Bluebell, Pennsylvania, which I think is over near where you are now.
That's pretty cool. I haven't heard of Bell before. Yeah, we'll see how this works. The house, it's pretty nice. We went from a 2-bedroom apartment on the first floor of a house in West Orange, New Jersey. And now we have basically 3 floors. So the main floor, a floor with bedrooms, and then I'm in the attic right now. And I get to set this up as my office and a ham radio shack. And we'll put a few other things up here. But it's a lot more space than before. The other really nice thing is my office on campus is absolutely beautiful. I put a few pictures on Facebook for anyone who saw that, but it's a really, really nice private office. And I have that. I put in a bunch of ham radios and things when I moved in there this weekend too. So I think that should help spark some interest.
So far you think you made the right decision then, right?
Yep, I think so. I mean, it really was the only decision because it was the only, tenure track position available.
Oh, that's okay. So that's good. So that's definitely worth it then.
Absolutely. So yeah, things are going fine and I'm getting ready for classes. And as I mentioned, I did identify a student who is interested in coming to Tapper from Scranton. I sent you that email, Scotty. I'm not sure if you got that.
Yeah, I did get that, and I want to talk to you, but probably best to talk to you on the phone about it.
Okay, that sounds good.
So can I give you a call tomorrow? How does it look during the day for you, your schedule?
Yeah, you can give me a call anytime tomorrow, I think.
Okay, we'll do. I'll give you a call in the morning then when I get into work, which should probably be around lunchtime for you.
Okay, that should work out. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for finding somebody so quick. That's great.
Sure, no problem. So I guess the other things that I'm, when I get over to Tapper DCC, I guess I'll give a presentation again on where I think the project is going. And I think the thing I want to start working on is trying to figure out exactly what HF propagation or what HF measurement mode I want to run as the standard, like full-time measurement mode. And I think that will help that part of the project.
Okay, because I'd like to give a kind of an update on the data engine. I don't know, Tom, are you going to DCC?
Yeah, I'm planning to be there. I haven't put together any kind of presentation.
Okay, because it seems like we could have like a tripartite thing where, and maybe we could twist Rick's arm into talking about clocks or John or both Rick and John, and get kind of a clock, RF board, DE kind of together.
Oh, sure. That'd be a good idea. You know, should we combine it all into one session for like three or four of us? Or should we have two? What do you think?
I think for a first go around, we ought to have separate sessions because, well, let's see what Steve comes up with. If Steve's really tight for sessions, then we can cram it in and do, you know, like 15 minutes each or something. If he's got room, then we can expand it out.
Okay, I haven't talked to Steve. If he needs a slot, go ahead and put my name in. If he doesn't, then I'll join up with you or whoever else we need to do. And a couple days notice ahead would be nice, so we know whether to bring 20 or two slides.
Okay, we can certainly do more notice than a couple days. And Rick, do you think you're interested in talking?
I had not planned on attending that this year, but I'll think about it.
Now, okay, very good. And, go ahead, Dave.
By up to the kid, Scotty's normal is to put like 65 or 70 slides.
Yeah, in 15 minutes, right?
That's right.
I do have a higher record than Bruce, though, and Bruce can go pretty fast.
Yeah, he tends to elaborate quite a bit on each one, but he takes lots of time. These are those things you learn from editing videos.
Oh, yeah. So you get to kind of time, get a gut feel for how fast the slides go by?
That's right.
Well, my trick is that I put a lot of slides with pictures on them that don't need to be up for very long.
Well, that's good.
When you put those slides up that have, 10 bullet items, you have to leave them up for a while or people will lynch you at the end.
Yeah, especially if you don't have a copy of the slides in the handouts.
Yeah, my favorite one is to put about four or five URLs up on the slide and leave it up for 3 seconds and ask everybody if they got it.
Okay, I'll do that.
Or you remember the Dilbert cartoon where Dilbert decided he'd put all of his slides on one page and it basically was completely full of ink and there was no white space.
Okay, so he used every single pixel on the slide?
Right. Just overlaid every slide on top of one page. So I don't know. I was going to try to do that, but I don't think I could probably crash PowerPoint with that.
Okay. Oh, gosh. I see the new OpenOffice 6.3 is out, and it's starting to look pretty attractive.
So is this the newest version of 365, or is this a different version?
I know. This is the OpenOffice, which is the free version that is available on Linux, and it is starting to look more and more Office-like every day.
Oh, right. OpenOffice. Okay. So is it kind of taken over and surpassed LibreOffice then, or is that what the competitor was?
Yeah, well, there's two of them. I don't know what happened. They forked apart a few years ago over some difference in opinion. I don't know the history. And OpenOffice ships with Ubuntu and some other distributions. I think LibreOffice may be on some different distributions. But I was on one of the older open offices, and I saw a YouTube video on 6.3, and it looked pretty cool, so I did a I added the PPA to the repository and sucked down 6.2.5, and my goodness, what a change. So it looks like I think 6.3 has got something like a ribbon, maybe not exactly a ribbon that Office has, but it's starting to go in that direction.
Oh, that's too bad. I hate the ribbon. I learned where all the menus were, and now they changed them all around, and there's still some table menus that I can't find, and I have to search for them every time because I don't know where they hid them.
Yeah, I'm usually, Google is my friend. I know something can be done, but you know, it's been 3 months since it was last done and can't remember it. And at least Google will normally find it quickly.
Well, the good thing about Office 365 is they got a search bar at the top. So you just type what you want to do in the search bar and you get it immediately. But since it doesn't tell you the menu that it's on, I can't go to that menu directly. I have to search for it every time.
Okay. Well, I've been burning up PowerPoint. The MUD conference is 2 weeks after DCC, and we've got, we're up to 50 slides for the GNU Radio seminar now. So it lots of PowerPoint's been coming out recently.
Yeah, so you're doing a GNU Radio presentation there, right?
Yeah, we're doing a seminar. Bob is helping. And we're going to do a 3-hour seminar. You know, it's the basics of how to install it on Windows. And then we've got 3 or 4 worked out examples where the people in the seminar, you know, have to do one example and then the next. And so they learn how to navigate it. And then at the end, we actually will do a single sideband QSO on 2304 megahertz. And we have the flow graph for that. And we're going to do a live QSO using GNU Radio.
Oh, cool. So is this like a Sunday seminar, or is this a separate track, or how do they work it?
It's a Thursday seminar. It's Thursday afternoon from 3 to 6. And so it's like the Sunday seminar, except it's before the conference rather than after.
And this is Bob McGuire and you are doing it?
No, Bob Strickland, NFI-BRG.
Oh, okay. Okay. And this is the one you're doing under Windows, right?
Yeah, it's all Windows. I've installed it. It works on 64-bit Windows, but not 32. So I've tested it on Windows 7 and Windows 10, and it installs clean and comes up and runs on both of those.
So are you going to have like thumb drives available for people to download or to install from?
Yeah, we'll have the PowerPoint slides, the software to install, the examples worked out, and I'm going to try to record a data set off the air this Saturday. The NAQP sideband contest is on, and so I'm going to have a data file. One of the exercises is tuning, you know, building a receiver that you can tune, and then for folks who don't have a receiver, we'll have the data file on the USB stick so they can play that. And then everyone who attends the seminar, I think, is going to get a USB stick.
Oh, so you're going to record NAQP, SSB? Is it going to be in 32-bit wave format? So it's maybe something I could share.
Well, it'll be in 32-bit floating point format because that's what is natively put out by GNU Radio. But I can post process it after the recording event to convert it to some other format. The problem is there's no 32-bit standard format, so it'll have to be 16-bit.
Oh, okay. Well, do you know what HDSDR uses?
No, I do not.
Yeah, and I don't either. And I kind of presumed it was 32-bit, but which is why I think, because you tried converting some of Nathaniel's files, right? And all you got was noise.
Yeah, the problem is all the conversion tools I have only know about 8-bit and 16-bit WAV file formats. GNU Radio will not let you enter 32-bits as a valid WAV format.
Yeah, so that's unfortunate. So I can't really, probably won't be able to do anything with it then to convert it, at least not with GNU Radio.
Yeah, so if there's some other format specifier that somebody has done, and I can look at it and see if there's a way to convert single point or single precision floating point INQ to some other format. But in searching for such a tool, I haven't found it so far. I just may not have looked in the right place.
Well, I guess the first thing to do is to figure out what HDSDR needs, if that's what I'm going to use for playback. I guess I could use a GNU Radio Flow Graph and you could just record it in 16-bit. I mean, just convert it to 16-bit, and then you could play it back in GNU Radio, right?
Yeah, well, I'm going to record it in the 30 in single precision floating point IMQ, and GNU Radio knows how to play that back because that's its native I/O disk format.
Oh, okay. So that might be a solution also.
Yeah, that's what the exercise is going to be at the seminar. Is we'll have that format disk file, and we have a one of the exercises set up where it reads in that file from the USB stick and plays it, and then you can use your flow graph to tune around and listen to things. And so that'll be one of the exercises that the people at the seminar will go through.
Okay, sounds good.
I asked Bob, do you have a big USB stick? Because the files are huge, and so it may only be a few minutes of contest recording because the file sizes get very, very large real fast.
Yeah, I know Fry's had 256 gig sticks on sale last week, and they were like $23, which is amazingly cheap price, but still, you're not going to want to give those away.
Yeah, so I don't know. Bob Strickland's working on all that. I don't know what he's found, but I'm sure he'll get something big enough. You know, even a few gigabytes will give, you know, a few minutes. One of the neat things about GNU Radio is you can loop a file, so you can tell it to play a file and then loop it. So, you know, if you've recorded 5 minutes, it'll just replay that 5 minutes over and over again until you stop it.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds good. It's kind of like what we do at Hamvention with John Ackerman replays the 7QP from 3 years ago.
Yeah, all that stuff works pretty well. Scotty, I had a couple questions about SPI and I2C, if you have a minute.
Okay, shoot.
In the revised definition of the connector, we are sharing two pins between SPI and I2C, the clock, which is a unidirectional pin, and the data, which is a bidirectional pin. In I2C, but it's a unidirectional pin in SPI. Is that going to present a problem?
That's a good question. If the SPI device, I think it'll be okay. It depending on if the SPI device outputs its MOSI pin, MISO pin, it's master in, slave out. If it drives that while it's deselected, then it's not going to work. But if it doesn't, then by taking the chip select away, if it really, in fact, the SPI devices get off the bus, then it should work okay. And yeah, it is a little bit squirrely. The thing about it is that we can make the FPGA code do whatever we want. So if it's non-standard, that's okay. But of course, obviously, if someone else is driving the line, you can't drive it too.
Okay, so the reason I asked is because the FPGA is going to have to drive the line sometimes. It's going to have to listen to the line sometimes when it's in I2C format. But when it's in SPI format, the FPGA is going to be in listen-only mode.
Yeah, yeah, and I know when we shared the lines from between the SPI port and the I2C port with the attenuators on Hermes, IQ2, we picked the input line for the data because the attenuators are input only, so you never read them back, so the direction was correct. So when the SPI line, SPI chip select is high, the SPI devices ignores the input line, and the attenuators they're not really SPI. They're kind of like a sort of SPI, you know. I mean, sort of I2C. They're just clock and data, and they don't really have any address or anything. They just have data line. You know, so you pull the chip select low and you clock in your 16 bits of data. Or 13 bits of data, however many it is, and then pull the chip select back high.
Okay. The other option is to use the I2C lines that drive the EEPROM, the identification EEPROM, and that the addition would be that the FPGA would have to drive three chip select lines to the correct state when it first recognized the board, but then we wouldn't have any possible conflicts. The three chip selects are really are going to have to drive a 3 of 8 decoder on the receiver module anyway, because some some of the chips, can't use just a single chip select line. So I think we're going to end up having to decode those on the board.
User disconnected from your channel.
Yeah, the attenuators should get their own chip select, their own, and just share the clock and the data. And then the spy port should get its own chip select and share both data and the clock. And I think that'll work without having to have a decoder. Unless, of course, you have to put an expander or something on there, and in which case it might not work depending on what the expander required.
Yeah, we're going to need at least one expander for GPIO. And it took, I've got a table in the ICD of the chip select bits, because we need at least one bit to turn the noise relays on and off.
So we're going to have to decode those chip selects, or, we could use another I/O pin. And we've got all of the data outs, the differential data outs. You just program one of those as a serial data out and use that as another chip select.
Okay, well, those are all possible. I figured, we could. Oh, okay, sorry, something happened there. I figured we could, we have three chip selects and we have plenty of states of the eight possible states to decode all three lines, but we'll come up with something that works. Just wanted to make sure we hadn't painted ourselves into a corner.
Yeah, Tom, you've got either a lot of breath on your microphone, or there's a loose connection, because there's a lot of static when you're talking. So maybe something's loose.
Okay, is this any better?
Nope, about the same.
All right. Well, not sure what happened there. I can't hear myself. Can't hear myself talk, so let me try tweaking something.
Okay, and you can listen to the recording later and see what it sounds like, but I thought it was just the popping P's and things like that for the microphone, but it seems to be there even when you back way off.
Okay, well, it's a USB headset, so I don't have any analog. All the electronics are up in the headset, so if it's noising up, I probably have to tear the headset apart.
Or just move it from away from directly in front of your mouth and see if maybe it can pick up the noise to the voice from the side. That might work.
Okay. Yeah, it's got a boom thing, but it doesn't go sideways. It just goes up and down. I can try pushing it a little further up so it's further from my mouth.
Well, that came through perfect that time.
Okay. Well, maybe I just had it down too low. I've got it up about the tip of my nose, so maybe there's a lesson to be learned on headsets there.
Yeah, and that time there was a little bit on it, but not really much. It was perfectly Q5, as they say. So anyway, this week I'm going to try to after I get done with my presentation, I'm going to try to flesh out the ICD a little bit more and run it by you. And if we can get enough in there, I think I can pretty much finish it with all the things that I need to put in there, and I can post it.
Okay, that'll be good. If there's any changes you need to make, let me know, and then I'll rev the receiver one at the same time.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe prefixing all of the signals with RFM, and I would do the same thing with the DE end, because I noticed you didn't do that with the clocks, only just with the transmit datas. But we do have clock ins and clock outs that have the same kind of problem, since you're going to connect your ins to my outs.
Okay, I'll go ahead and I'll take a note to fix that in the ICD.
And then what do you think about what we have to do left on the clock ICD to... We need to talk with Rick or John or both and try to get that hammered down so that we could have a clock module a spec for the connector, because I'm going to need that for the data engine also, because it's got to plug in there.
Yeah, I there is an ICD for the clock module. At the time I put it out, I hadn't really thought it was an M.2, and of course there's not too many data buses. It also has an SPI and an I2C, and one possibility is to use the identical pins that we specified in the receiver and specify the MEC connector, or we may want to have an entirely different connector. But you might want to think about that, and then I can modify the clock module appropriately.
Well, I'd like to stick with the M.2 connector if it's got enough pins, because it's very cheap and it's high enough speed for whatever we need, as long as there's enough pins on it.
Oh, yeah, on the clock module, there's no problem. There's just the SPI, the I2C, and a couple of others, so it doesn't have very many IOs at all.
Yeah, and then we need the 4 clock outputs, and we need some pins to steer a DAC, right, or something like that. And then what kind of voltages do you think we need?
Yeah, the DAC will be on the clock board, and all of the steering will be between the GPS receiver block and the DAC and the low pass filter and amp and stuff. So that's all contained on the module. The clock spec lists what comes off. There'll be four high speed synthesizer clocks, which will be differential, and the pulse per second signal, which will also be differential since it's a high speed signal, and the SPI and I2C. There may be one or two others, but there's really not too many signals. I can go back and take another look at that, or I can wait until you've looked at it. Let me know your preference. If you want me to take another look and rev the I2C, I'll go, or ICD for the clock, I'll go ahead and do that.
Yeah, let me go and take a look at it and see what I can. I haven't really spent a lot of time looking at that document, so I need to do that. And I'm thinking the extra pins, we can define them as GPIOs to the FPGA, and then we can use them for whatever we need to later if we want to do that. And then I'm thinking, do we want to make any of the DAC pins or the steering pins available to the FPGA or not?
I'm not sure. That would be a question. The GPS block will be driving the DAC, and so the GPS block should know the state of what it is driving to the DAC. And I would hope that anything important about that state would come out through the SPI interface.
Okay, so the DAC, the steered oscillator, and the GPS are all going to be on the same board, so they all connect together locally.
Yeah, the GPS block has a couple of pins that are defined to drive an external DAC. And there are DACs available that you can just basically wire the DAC right to those pins on the GPS block. And I think they're serial, I'm not sure. And it will send the DAC control words, and then there'll be a filter behind the DAC. And then after that filter will be the voltage controlled oscillator. And all of that really has to be on the same module, because you need to keep the noise on the voltage control line to the oscillator very, very low and very tightly controlled. So that's not the kind of a signal you'd want to go through a connector.
Yeah. So consider this. One of the options for the clock module that I'd like to do is a couple options maybe. So the GPSDO is the high-end one. It has the GPS and the steered oscillator and all that. But I'd like to be able to put a relatively low-cost VCXO onto that board, like the Crystek part that we used in the Hermes board. And I want to be able to steer it with the FPGA. So we would put the DAC for that oscillator on the clock board, but the control for it is going to come from the FPGA. So we need to reserve some pins for that. And I don't believe, well, of course, maybe we could use the same pins, because if you plug that one in, you're not going to have a spy port other than the one that's controlling the VCXO.
Yeah, you could. I would think that the update rate to that oscillator would be pretty slow. And so you could easily use an I2C or an SPI interface to send control words to that kind of a DAC.
Yeah, because I know what we did in the in Hermes is we had a poor man's DAC. We had basically a PWM output with a low-pass filter on it, and that never worked well. So, but I don't want to put a DAC on the data engine. I'd much rather put the DAC on the board that needs it, so I'd like to put the control signals, which I think, like you said, are already going to be there, so I think we can do that. And I'm trying to think how... Yeah, because if you're going to control it with SPI or I2C, is it really going to update fast enough?
Oh, yeah. The kind of control rates that you're typically looking for are, hertz, 1 hertz, or even lower kind of update rates.
Okay, so like every hertz, every second, then you would update it. And you'd adjust it maybe a hundredth of a hertz or even finer than that?
Yeah, typically what happens is every second, you know, you look at the pulse per second signal that you get out of GPS, and you decide whether the oscillator produced a pulse that was too early or too late, and so you filter that, and then you apply a correction to the oscillator. So if you would do that separately, I would imagine you probably wouldn't update any faster. Typically, the bandwidth of those control loops are less than 1 hertz.
Okay. So then we could do it with the pins. So we'd have we'd really look at one of the four output pins and use that as our reference, and then we generate the control voltage by writing to the DAC on the clockboard. Okay, that would work. So then the only problem I'm seeing is, since I'd like to have onboard clocks and not use an oscillator or a clock module at all in the low cost case, I'd like to see if I can find a 4-channel differential clock distribution chip, like something from On Semiconductor maybe, that I can put right next to the clock receiver, a clock M2 connector, and I can use a ground pin on the M.2 connector to switch the thing to tri-state. So I don't know if that's very clear or not. Maybe I should write this up and post it and let people look at it. But the idea is you either get your 4 clocks from the clock module if it's plugged in and the onboard one's tri-stated, or if it's not plugged in, then the onboard one would be driven and it would drive the same exact 8 lines that the clock module would drive. But of course, there's no clock module there. And then it becomes just a layout issue to see if you can get the stub short enough for it to work.
Yeah, those clocks are incredibly sensitive in terms of the cleanliness needed. That's the 122.88 low phase noise, low jitter clock for the system. And so great care has to be taken in the differential wiring of those clock signals.
Right, and I think we can do that, because the thing I really want to try to avoid is having to take to basically build a multiplexer. And I don't want to add a clock buffer so that our expensive our GPSDO steered oscillator then has to go through a buffer to get to the RF modules. I don't want to degrade it with that.
Okay, we'll have to look at ways to do that. The stubs, stubs can be okay if they're small enough and low enough capacitance. But if those stubs, get up into the hundreds of picoseconds or nanosecond range, it could be an issue. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I mean, here's something I just thought of. What we could do is we could have a dummy clock board that just had connections on it from one pin to another and make them adjacent pins. And you could have the onboard clock oscillator feed its clocks to the clock module. And if there was no clock module, basically there'd always have to be a clock module, but it might be a $2 blank that just is a dummy that passes the clocks through. And then you could daisy chain everything. There'd be no stubs.
Yeah, that could work, and it would certainly be clean.
Yeah, so now let me look at that a little bit, and maybe this next week we can do with that what we did with the receiver connector, kind of brainstorm a little bit about how we can get the clocking system down. Because I think that really would be useful to have like a kind of a block diagram of the flow of the clocking system on the boards.
Okay, yeah, I could see that would be useful. That approach is good also in that the GPSDO clock module, just has its normal 4 o'clock outputs, so that folks who want to use that module for some totally unrelated purpose, have a nice, clean, friendly module they don't have to worry about clock inputs to. They would just have a clock output. So that could all work together.
Yeah, so then the clock inputs to the M.2 connector would just be unused on the GPSDO, right?
Exactly.
And then what I'd like to do is I'd still like to have some kind of tri-state control to turn off the onboard clocks to keep the noise down low.
Sorry, I hit the wrong key. I'll have to look at the spec for the synthesizer. Those outputs are coming directly off the synthesizer IC, and they may be tri-statable. I'm not sure. I'm going to have to go look at the data sheet.
Well, if we do the daisy chain trick, only the ones on the board would have to be tri-statable. And actually, I take that back. Neither one would have to be tri-statable. But my point is that I don't want the local oscillator on the board driving the connector to open inputs that are not used when you plug in the GPSDO, because you're just going to, it's just going to generate noise. So one of the things we could do is we could disable the local oscillator, and you don't necessarily have to disable the drivers as long as the oscillator isn't running.
Yeah, I've got the I got the spec sheet up here. You have control over all the outputs on the synthesizer chip, and you know, you may be able to drive all of them to the not toggling state, or you may be able to. I'll have to read through it. I think in the case of the GPSDO module, you're going to want most of them going all the time for any practical use into the DE. And so I'm not sure what the case is where those synthesizer outputs are on the GPSDO board. The board's plugged into the DE and they're not toggling. What would that case be?
Well, if you're using the GPSDO, you'd always have those outputs on. But in the case of using the GPSDO, the onboard oscillator and the onboard buffers, the four channels that you feed as inputs to the GPSDO would not be used. If you have the dummy clock module, they would be used. They'd feed directly to the outputs. If you don't have the dummy one, then you'd have the GPSDO driving the board and the local oscillator on the board coming up to the connector and driving nothing. So that would just generate noise.
Okay, I'm not clear here. The GPSDO module, is this local oscillator the one on the GPSDO module or the one on the data engine?
The one on the data engine. So what you do is on the M.2 connector, you'd have four inputs, four differential inputs, and four differential outputs. On the GPSDO, the differential inputs would be unused, and the differential outputs would be driven by the synthesizer chip. And in the case where you're not using the GPSDO, you'd insert a dummy clock module that would take the four inputs and just wire them over to the four outputs. And then those four inputs would come from the data engine up onto the connector and then back off the connector, but they'd be all daisy chains, so they would flow smoothly. So did it help any?
Yeah, but if that's the case, then the GPSDO doesn't need to turn off or tri-state its outputs.
It does not. The local board has to. The DE does.
Ah, okay. Thanks. I think that cleared up my confusion.
I mean, they wouldn't really have to be turned off because they're not used for anything, but I don't like the idea of an unterminated trace with a 100 megahertz clock driving it. That is just asking for trouble.
Yeah, but so it would be the data engine that would have to decide not to drive the line.
Right, and if the buffers were not tri-statable, then the clock oscillator itself, if it has an enable, you could just stop the oscillator because obviously it's the transitions that cause the noise.
Okay, you just need to find the right kind of buffer IC for inclusion on the data engine.
Right, right. And did you say that the synthesizer, the outputs could be, I know you said you could stop them. Can you tri-state them?
Well, I'm trying to figure that out. I opened up the first document and didn't give me any help in that department. So I'm going through document number two here.
Yeah, I think we'll be really lucky if that actually all works.
Okay, well, a search of the word tri-state on this spec didn't yield anything.
Yeah, because I really don't want to put an extra buffer in line with our high buck anti-jitter machine.
Yeah, so I don't know if the synthesizer chip can have that done. Of course, for the GPSDO, it doesn't matter since they'll all be running anyway.
Right, right. That's true. The GPS. Oh, so that's okay. So all that matters is that if I can high Z the buffers on the data engine, then I can drive the M.2 connector outputs directly. And the only thing I sacrifice is I get a little stub on those lines coming off the connector.
Yeah, but if you're not driving the lines, does it matter?
Yeah, if because it'd come off of the M.2 connector and then there'd be a stub to the buffer that's in the high Z state. So it'd be basically an open stub.
Okay, I guess I'm still confused. If you're not driving the line and it's tri-stated, why does it matter if there's a stub?
No, because I pulled a switcheroo on there. What I decided in the second case was instead of having inputs on the connector and outputs on the connector, you just have outputs on the connector and you just connect the two sets of buffers in parallel. So the one case would be the data, the GPS DO plugged into the M.2 connector and the buffers on the DE High Z, and they're connected in parallel. The other case would be you don't plug a DE, a clock module in at all, and then the buffers on the board would have to be turned on and drive the same exact lines that the GPS DO drives.
Okay. So if the GPS DO is on and plugged in and it's driving stubs, that's an issue.
Right, right. So you'd end up driving. Now, you might be able to rig it so that, well, it's almost impossible to not have one or the other have stubs on it. I mean, you can't wire them both unless you can, if you have a plug-in board, you just can't do it.
Yeah, this may be impossible to design by TeamSpeak call.
Yeah, but the alternative is maybe if you could keep the stub to, 100 mils or something, then maybe that's sufficient.
Yeah, we probably will need to work those ICDs offline probably. I suspect a one-on-one and drafting the document may be useful.
Yeah, so the problem is that you can spec it, but if we make it impossible for the PC board designer to do, then it's not going to work, right?
Right, right. Well, hopefully the people discussing it will think about the PC board designer.
So just out of curiosity, what's your opinion? If we had a trace from a clock, 122 megahertz clock, differential, through a connector, onto the board, across the board, up to another connector, and we terminate it on the far end, on the RF board, and it's a point-to-point clock, so it only goes one place, because we have four of them, one for each RF board, and one to the FPGA, so that's, and there's actually, so that's three. How much of a stub do you think we can tolerate at 100 megahertz, especially if the stub is very close to the source?
That's a fairly analog question. The connectors have a differential impedance in the 85, 90 ohm range, and so every connector trace will put a small bump. And then if we have stubs on top of that, my gosh, it's all going to depend on the length of the wires to the connector and where the stubs are as to whether they'll interact or not.
Yeah, because I'm guessing then on the clock board, you're going to have termination, like 100 ohm termination at the source. Then you're going to have some length of trace. Then you're going to have the connector. And then you're going to have some length of trace. Then you're going to have the RF module connector. Then you're going to have another trace on that board to over to the ADC. And then you're going to terminate the trace there with another 100 ohm differential terminator, right?
Well, yeah, I was assuming that the GPS DO clock module would drive 122 through its MEC connector and down onto the data engine and up through the, would go through the M.2 connector onto the data engine board and up through the MEC connector to the receiver. So there'd be two connectors, a source and a sink, and the source and sink would be appropriately terminated. And then there'd be a separate connection going from the GPS DO through the M.2 down to the data engine and over to the FPGA. So I'm only thinking of the one case here right now where I only see unidirectional coupling and I see two connectors in the path between the module and the receiver.
Right, right. Okay, I get that. That's perfect. But then imagine a tri-state buffer that is going to be connected to the M.2 connector. Now we can physically put that buffer right on top of the trace, and the only time that buffer will ever be turned on is when there's nothing plugged into the M.2 connector, which means the stub length is going to be only the length of that pin in that connector up to the non-existent clock board.
But you have the capacitance of the driver. When the driver is tri-stated and turned off, you have fairly significant output buffer capacitance on the line.
Yeah, 7.3 there, Dave. Yeah, so that's the problem, is you're going to have that load capacitance, so you're going to have to deal with that.
Yeah, we're going to have to think this one through. I really don't completely understand things, but I think that amount of capacitance is going to be a problem.
So then we're back to the daisy chaining and reserving the pins on the M.2 and having a dummy GPS DO plug.
Well, that I think would end up being the cleanest solution.
Yeah, and then you really don't even need to have tri-states. You just need to stop the oscillator to keep the noise level low.
Yeah, yeah. The FPGA can, you know, has the logic to not drive pins, or you know, you can stop other clocks. But yeah, we have to be careful, because that one clock, that 122.88 clock, that governs the performance of the receiver.
Right, right. But the whole idea was, on the low cost board, we're going to have a moderate performance 122.88, and we'll be able to use that clock to drive the whole system, FPGA and the receiver boards. And then when you want to upgrade, use the GPSDO with the high quality clock, and it's basically the same frequency but lower phase noise and lower jitter, right?
Yeah, yeah. So what I'm worried about is jitter on that clock line, because the A to D receive sensitivity is a strong function of jitter, and at 30 megahertz, even a picosecond of jitter on the clock knocks dB of sensitivity out of the A to D converter.
Okay, just keep in mind, not all configurations use that receiver module.
True, but for the case that it does, you have the severe requirement.
Right, right. So that was my point, is I don't want to put a crummy buffer in line that ruins our fancy GPSDO that we work so hard to get clean, and then we plug in that receiver board, then we get it degraded because of the buffer we put in line.
Yeah, so that's why I think we need a non-buffered stub-free path in high case, and then do something different for the other case.
Right, right. And I think I'm coming to agree with you there. One of the things I thought of was you could actually have two different clock inputs on the RF modules, but that's problematic, because that means the same RF modules won't work with a clock module or without, and that's not what the goal is here.
Yeah, so I think your first plan of looping through the clocks with a dummy board may be a workable solution.
Yeah, because that, you know, we could lay that board out as what do they call that? It's not a key. It's you know, when they put stubs on printed circuit board runs, so they can do impedance measurements. We can just put a little stub connector on the side of every data engine, and we get the board for free.
Okay. Well, yeah. There's a little bit of thinking to do. It sounds like on the interface connector to the clock module, and so you bring up good points, and we're going to need to go rev those documents.
Yeah, but do you think we have enough pins for eight more differential inputs?
You mean four differential inputs or eight?
Well, eight pins, four differential inputs.
Oh, okay. Yeah, eight. I think so. There's about 60. I think 67, 66 pins on the M.2 after you take away the, you know, the key slot. And so I think there's enough pins, but I'll have to go look at the spec.
Yeah, there's 68 pin, 67, 75 pin connector and eight keyways. So yeah, so, and we'd probably want to make them immediately adjacent, so they get the least, either on the opposite side of the board, and probably on the same side of the board, because you really want them to just flow right through with the minimal impedance bump.
Yeah, the M.2 in use requires differential pairs be on consecutive odd pins or on consecutive even pins in order to maintain the 100 ohm differential impedance.
Well, then we're going to have to run them to the opposite side, aren't we?
I haven't thought about the layout. Yeah, they'll end up on opposite sides of the circuit board that plug in.
Right, right. Okay, and then you just put all of that as a single via between it, or maybe we can use two vias for lower inductance.
I'll have to think about that. The yeah, they'll end up on different sides. I'm not sure that's how much of it's an issue. When you lay out the high-performance module, the GPSDO, you can put all the synthesizer outputs on the same side. And then the loop through, yeah, they could come in on the even and go out on the odds, and then they just have to loop through. But those loop throughs on that board are real darn short, and they'd be pretty close to the connector pin. So for the lower performance case, probably wouldn't make any difference.
Well, you're just going to put vias right at the pads, so they're going to be about as short as they possibly can be.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't looked at it again. The M.2s, I think they're down around 90 ohms differential when you go up through the connector. There was an app note on what impedance to expect on M.2s, and some folks say plan on 100. Some say it's 100 except for the 2/10 of an inch of the connector where they're 85 or 90 ohms. So there's a small bump, and if you have a short via, you get a double bump. On the low performance case, that may not be much of an issue.
Okay, well, we'll look at that and see. In fact, I guess my first choice would be to try to live with the capacitance of the Hi-Z driver, but we can take a look and see what kind of parts they've got available. And if that's not going to be acceptable, if you really think it's not going to work, then we'll go back to the feed through case, which I think works in any case.
Yeah, okay. That's a good point. I remember seeing models of the connector path performance, and in Ethernet committee, and the signal lines, of course, are quite a bit higher speed, but in those cases, femtofarads of capacitance were causing issues.
Wow, so that means all you got to do is screw up the spacing between the differential pair at one point and you've got a problem.
Yeah, of course, they're running a lot higher frequency. Those clocks were, I think that modeling was done up at around 25 gigahertz. And, there the connector models were looking at, 100 femtofarads was a problem.
Yeah, so realistically, what kind of clock speed do you think we can get out of that synthesizer chip? Isn't it? It's going to be limited to about 200 megahertz, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll go up higher. The synthesizer chip will go up quite a bit higher than that. Again, I'd have to open the spec to look at it. I think the part we were looking at, they'll go up to about 400 megahertz.
Okay, so we don't need to really concern ourselves too much trying to drive it higher than that frequency, unless maybe at some point we're going to use a different clock chip.
Yeah, it's not the clock rate I'm worried about. It's the edge rate of the clock that's the issue.
Yeah, so what it occurred to me is, this sounds stupid, but suppose you get 10 puff on the line, which is, a lot for a fast edge. Couldn't you just slow the edges down so that it wouldn't become an issue?
Yeah, you slow the edges down and you increase the jitter substantially.
Oh, okay, so it's directly proportional to the speed of the edge?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so one design criteria says fast edge, the other says slow edge, so there you go.
Yeah, that's the difficulty. We're trying to achieve an ultra-low edge jitter clocking signal to the A to D converter, and so the criteria on it are a little unusual compared to a lot of applications that you see.
And then, of course, if you slow the edges down differently on two different channels, then they're not, I guess that just gives you, if the jitter's still low, I guess that just gives you a phase difference, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, there'll be one clock signal coming into the dual channel RF module, and then it'll have a driver that I don't know if the dual ADC has a single input or has two different clock inputs. If it has a single clock input, we may be able to just drive it directly from the connector. But jitter, what happens is when you jitter an ADC, you degrade the noise. And so the signal-to-noise ratio on that ADC degrades as a function of the frequency that you're trying to digitize. So the whole goal here is to have a differential edge that is jitter-free going into that ADC clock.
Right, it is one clock input. So the issue then would be trying to synchronize multiple receivers boards across the, so we'd have two separate clocks that would have each have their own differential prices. And we can get our CAD guy to make the differential pairs the exact same length. I mean, I don't mean the plus and minus, but I mean both clock A and clock B, both pair, all four wires would be the same length.
Yeah, I think that may not be too important. The reason is as long as the clock difference across receiver modules is stable and doesn't change with time, then everything's okay. For example, a quad channel receiver where you've got a dual and a dual, if they were to have a clock phase difference, that would just be additive to the phase difference from the antennas going through the coaxial cables and the filters. All of those are going to be much larger phase differences than the ones that we'll have on the clock. And so we'll have a pre-calibration step that we'll go through to equalize out all of the antenna and cable delays. And then as long as things sit stable and don't move, we're okay. So I'm not worried about a clock phase difference. What I'm worried about is jitter on the clock. And then secondly, clocks drifting with respect to one another.
Yeah, so I don't think we have to worry about the drifting with clocks that are generated by all generated by the same clock driver chip. But we have to worry about the stable phase difference between those four outputs, right?
Yeah, so right, exactly right. So you don't want them to move around too much because they'll start to degrade the coherence of the receive signals. But you have room for a little bit of movement there. It's not that awful. The larger effects are going to be the coaxial cables from the receive antennas into the receiver. They'll have temperature effects, they'll have mechanical effects. Those are going to be the big contributors. So I'm not really worried about the clocks drifting on the electronics. I think that will be insignificant by comparison. What I'm worried about is the edge jitter, because that will have a directly measurable impact on the sensitivity.
Yeah, and I mean, different edge jitter on different outputs just looks like an instantaneous phase difference, right?
Yeah, it's a time difference, but the jitter that we're, the spec for the part is plus or minus a picosecond, right? And so, you don't hook your scope up and take a look.
Yeah, really. Well, I don't know. We got a 10 gigahertz scope, but still, I don't think that would show us much. By the time we get the signal into the scope, it's different.
Right. So that's what I say. The specs here are non-obvious specs that we're trying to achieve. The instruments that you want to have to take a look at them are not easy to find. The easiest way may be to see how badly does the SNR degrade on the converter chip and use that as an indication of whether or not we've got a clean clock.
The converter chip being the synthesizer, you mean?
No, the ADC, the analog to digital converter.
Oh, okay. How much does it do? So really there's a jitter spec for the encode input, which is what they call their clock input, right?
Yeah, and I put that graph in the spec for the module. Even though the clock jitter on the synthesizer controls it, anything we do from there on out makes it worse, and that's why I put the table in the receiver specification.
So how does it look on the ADC compared to the output of the synthesizer?
Right. That's exactly what the receiver specification has to control, is how much of a degradation does the receiver module place on what comes out of the synthesizer?
Well, if the ADC is very sloppy in its conversion, then you're not going to gain a lot by having a really low phase noise oscillator coming in. But obviously, if it's really sloppy, then we need to pick a better ADC, right?
Yeah, that ADC that we're looking at is in the hundreds of femtoseconds in terms of its internal jitter.
So our clock's really going to be the controller.
Absolutely.
Well, I think maybe this feed through the connector idea, that might actually save the bacon here, because although I really hate to have a dummy board, it's better than having a noisy clock.
It's one of my concerns on the performance. How all of that works is gonna determine how the receiver plays.
Okay, very good. So that means it would be worth working on the clock tree documentation a little bit to make sure we get this right.
Okay, I'll put that on the list for the week.
Wow, you're a workhorse.
That has to be the most esoteric discussion that's probably flowed through TeamSpeak so far.
Yeah, really, talking about femtoseconds of degradation. Okay, well, we've really run over our hour here, but I think it was a good discussion, so I appreciate it. Thanks, Tom.
Well, thank you, Scotty, and thanks to everybody for tolerating us.
Thank you very much.